You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He's shattered from all. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538, the podcast about the week in sports narrative. I'm Chadwick Matlin, editor of 538. Across the table from me is Neil Payne. Hi, Neil.
What's up, Chad?
Neil, yesterday I was walking and I had a brainstorm about a different way to introduce the show, that it wasn't 538's podcast about the week in sports narrative. It was brilliant, this brainstorm, because we've never liked saying the week in sports narrative. And then I forgot. What it was.
Chad.
It was really good. Listeners, if you have a better intro line, email us at podcast@538.com.
Immediately make a voice memo to yourself when you have thoughts like this. Come on.
You will hear no other third voice, listeners, and that's because it's just me and Neil. Neil and I in
the
studio.
Just the two of us.
Neil and me in the studio. It's just me in the studio because it's a special episode. It's
Real
an episode
special.
We wanted to get into your hands as soon as possible this week. It's also the last time we are recording live. You're not going to hear us live covering the news until 2016, but there's a reason for it. And
it's
that
a special reason
is our special guest. Commissioner Adam Silver is on the podcast today. You may know him from such things as the NBA draft or halftime at an NBA game with an interview in the stands, let's say. Longtime listeners will remember that earlier this year, we had a project to fix the NBA draft. We crowdsourced ideas from you, the listeners. Thousands of them came in, ranging from everything from Adam Silver riding a bear to pick who should get the first draft to our eventual winner, which was a draft futures idea, which was that teams could trade their rights to each other's draft picks with one another. Am I summarizing that correctly, Neil?
Yeah, but you forgot the bear aspect of that. No, there was no bear aspect to that, although I feel like every proposal should have included something grizzly bear related.
Yes.
But yes, the teams could bet on other teams' records and therefore be able to, you know, sort of their draft position would not depend on their own badness. It would depend on their ability to predict the badness of other teams, which is, we thought it was very cool. We got a response back from Adam Silver, who's like, yeah, it's all right. It needs a little work. You know, we'll think about it, that kind of thing. So I'm interested in seeing what he has to say in person.
And so ever since we got that FedEx, we've been trying to get Commissioner Silver onto the podcast. It took months of dogged work from our production crew, but he is here today. Commissioner Adam Silver, welcome to Hot Takedown. Glad to have you.
Glad to be here.
So we were just talking about our NBA draft crowdsourcing project that I know you're familiar with. And when we were originally soliciting for ideas, someone came up with the idea of you riding a bear to fix the draft. That would be how we fix the draft. And the bear would eat a certain kind of fish. That fish would be a team, and then we'd know who gets the first pick. We're going to make T-shirts with the illustration we commissioned of you doing that. Can we send you a T-shirt, Commissioner Silver?
I'm in.
All right, what size are you?
And you can send me a T-shirt.
Okay, excellent. You're in for the bear.
On the bear and the
I'm
fish,
in
too.
For the whole thing, not just a T-shirt.
Excellent. Are you mediums, large?
I'm large, I think.
Okay, all right.
So, Commissioner, in the letter that you sent us in reply, you had written that there appears to be a growing consensus that we should reform the draft lottery. And we took that to mean that you're having an ongoing conversation about the relationship between team performance and their draft position. Are there any updates on that front or specific plans for reform that you're considering?
Well, and there are ongoing discussions. And I think you guys know, over a year ago, we took a proposal to the Board of Governors and ultimately a proposal to change the current odds for the worst performing teams. And that proposal was voted down, not because a majority of the teams weren't in favor of it, but because it requires three quarters of the owners to approve it. At the time that was voted down, we then, in essence, decided to park the issue because we knew our competition committee wouldn't be meeting in a serious way until the following summer, which was this past summer. And then we knew, as all the new cap room would be coming in because of the new television deals, that there was so much at play in terms of predicting team behavior with an unprecedented increase in cap room, as we're going to have next season, that we thought, let's wait, let's see how the system plays out before we turn back to it. So it's ongoing, and the proposals that you guys sent and your readers sent were really helpful. I mean, a lot of them are similar to things that we've been looking at. Other things have come in over the transom. I will say, the law of unintended consequences always seems to be at work here at the league. And so I've learned over my 20 years plus here that we got to be very careful when we start tinkering, because the teams are incredibly imaginative and clever and come up with new approaches once we start changing odds. And if we're changing the odds of them getting picks. And the other thing we realize is that they should be allowed to plan. And I think that's one of the reasons why we propose smoothing in the cap increase to our teams, so that those teams that had been planning for free agency would deserve to have an advantage of sorts. And now we get it. We did these new TV deals. We're fortunate to have them. The increases were greater than I think that we had modeled for initially when we did the new collective bargaining agreement. And so we'll happily live with it. But for all of those reasons, draft lottery change is on hold.
That's really interesting, the idea of, you mentioned having people that try to predict team behavior. Do you have like a task force or, a group of people that just their job is to kind of envision the ways in which these loopholes, they'll find loopholes in the process or try to game the system?
We do. And in fact, there's a, he's a lawyer by training, although when you become a so-called cap lawyer at the NBA and you haven't practiced real law in a long time, I'm not sure if you still deserve the label lawyer, but there's a guy named Dan Rube at the league office, and he's been here probably close to 20 years at this point, and he is our in-house expert. He has a lot of folks who work with him as well, but he spends the bulk of his time on matters pertaining to the collective bargaining agreement, and we use, as we go into collective bargaining, outside experts. There's a professor at Yale named Barry Nailbuff. He's in the School of Management, their business school at Yale, and he's someone who worked with us the last round and has continued to work with us on modeling team behavior. I mean, think about it, especially when you're making adjustments in the so-called luxury tax. I think the issue then is, the goal is for teams to not want to spend the tax, because we'd like to have, and we've been very direct about this with the Players Association, we'd like to have the hardest possible tax. And it's been a compromise of sorts as we've increased the penalty for spending above the tax level, which, as you know, is somewhat above the cap level. But, we've generally been wrong that then a Russian oligarch comes in and spends further above the tax than we would have predicted when we modeled it. The issue for the league, there's sort of these pulleys and all kinds of mechanisms that we use to try to create parity in the league, and some work and some don't. But it's from the day we get a new agreement done, we're constantly modeling and thinking about how we can improve the system.
Yeah, financial analysts have the black swan effect. Maybe you need to have the Russian oligarch effect that you need to plan for. Real quick follow up on. That you said that the discussions about the draft are on hold. When do you anticipate them to be resumed? Is it after the new CBA is negotiated?
Well, probably before the new CBA is negotiated, because the big increase in cap room will come in this summer. For example, we're at roughly $70 million cap now, and we're anticipating going to $90 million, which is a dramatic increase. So I think we're going to get an opportunity to look at free agent behavior, how teams may react in terms of trades, how they may look at, if they look at the draft differently, really at this summer for the first time. So, we're continue to look at the issue. I'd also say that there's a marketplace issue at work as well. I think even from the last time we corresponded on the draft lottery proposal you sent me, clearly there's a resetting of sorts going on with the 76ers right now. And I think that ultimately may speak louder in the marketplace place of teams than any tinkering we do to the draft lottery.
That's actually what I wanted to ask you about next, which is the news out of Philadelphia where Jerry Colangelo is coming in to be the chairman of basketball operations. Anonymous reports suggested that that's due to owners who wanted that the situation in Philadelphia changed and that the league stepped in and did something. Are those reports correct?
Those reports are not correct. Josh Harris, who's the principal owner of the 76ers, decided on his own that he needed to change course. I can tell you that because he and I had many conversations along the way about the utility of the strategy that he was following. And he came to the conclusion, once the season began and he saw how his team was performing on the floor, that he needed to change his strategy. And other owners were not pressuring him at all. In fact, it's a weird dynamic in the league that, well, all the owners would like to see teams well operated, other owners just want to win. And so nobody was calling me and saying,
right, four free games a year.
Go call the 76ers and tell them how to beat us.
So the
pressure didn't come from other owners, and the pressure, frankly, didn't come from me. I mean, he and I had a lot of discussions when he reached the conclusion that he needed additional help. We discussed a list of names, and Jerry Colangelo was one of those names on the list, and I made the introduction. But I give him credit. He's ultimately responsible for his team. He's a relatively new owner. He tried a particular strategy, I would say. And when I say they changed course, I mean, clearly they're going to get a good draft pick again this year based on their record. And so that's part of an ongoing strategy. At the same time, I think in a healthy way, it's a realization from them that it's not just about getting high draft picks, that you have to create a winning culture. You have to bring in veterans to mentor younger players, and losing comes at an enormous cost, not just to the players on the floor, but to the community, to the ownership group, to the economics of the team. So there, you know, as I said to somebody the other day, that if ultimately we have a league where we have 30 well-managed teams, all with deep-pocketed, super smart owners aggressively managing their franchises, with 30 franchises, I know this is overly simplistic, but you would likely win once every 30 years. So therefore, there's got to be something more to owning a team than winning championships.
So then along those lines, are you personally, as the commissioner, okay with the way that the Sixers have run their franchise the past three seasons?
I don't want to answer that directly. I mean, only because it's, as I said, there's a marketplace of ideas and approaches that go into managing a franchise. I mean, for me, if a franchise is managed within the rules of the league, it's acceptable to me. I don't think I should be, browbeating owners and saying, this is how I think you should manage your team. And they got unlucky as well. I mean, if Joel Embiid were healthy and were on the floor, we maybe would be having a very different discussion. On the other hand, because of the strategy they were following, there was an extremely small margin for error. And so it's a combination, I would say, of their strategy and of bad luck, but bad luck is something that has to be factored in as well. So, am I a fan of that strategy? Put it this way, no. But does that mean that it's not acceptable under the league rules? It is, and it's partly why I had proposed to change the odds of the draft lottery. And incidentally, not just because I felt it would have a dramatic impact, that it would cause there to be a dramatic outcome in the results, but more because I was unhappy with the perception that was going around the league, which has been somewhat changed since then, that any team that wasn't following that strategy wasn't smart. I mean, you remember at the end of last season when the Knicks won a couple of those games, how critical, again, the marketplace was of them saying, well, what are you guys doing? You should be losing those games at the end of the season and give yourselves a better chance in the lottery. I mean, maybe I've been reading some of your commentary on your site about Chris Porzingis, and so we'll see. I mean, maybe he's a once in a generation player, and they got him at the fourth pick. So that only goes to how difficult it is to make these predictions, and why a strategy designed to be at the very bottom of the league may not ultimately make the most sense.
So I'm interested then about when you do step in as a commissioner. I mean, you're basically the CEO of a big multi-billion-dollar corporation. At what point does is it your responsibility to intervene if one of your franchises are not performing in a way that represents the league in a way that's positive?
Yeah, I would say that there's lots of different ways of so-called stepping in. And I just say that, you know, there's also cajoling and ongoing conversations that I have with owners, with team presidents, with general managers, where I'm expressing my opinion. And some of those are deserved to be private and privileged, which, you know, as communications are between commissioners and owners. But, I mean, clearly there's a line. If teams do something that is inappropriate, breaks a rule, whatever else, it's very public when I step in. But other than that, it's an odd dynamic being a commissioner. You're both, you work for the owners, but you work for them collectively and not for any individual owner. So it's a lot of relationship building. It's support, you know, it's the sharing of information. And even another odd dynamic in a league like this is that while every team desperately wants to win on the court, they also interestingly share best practices with each other. For example, we have a department at the NBA, we call it TEAMBO for short. It stands for Team Marketing Business Operations. It's run by a woman named Amy Brooks, who happened to play Division I basketball for Stanford, went to an NCAA championship, and then went on to Stanford Business School. And she runs this group. This goes maybe back to one of your questions before about who's studying these issues internally. They use a lot of data, a lot of analytics that they collect from the teams, and then they go out and, in essence, they cull information and share best practices. But at the end of the day, we're the first to say to a team, what may work in New York may require a very different approach in Oklahoma City, or then a very different approach from Phoenix to Portland. And so we share the information, but then ultimately the teams have to make decisions on their own as to what makes the most sense in their community for their players, et cetera.
One last question, Commissioner Silver. We're always interested.
I got a little more time.
Oh, you got more time. Okay.
We can go for another. I feel like I'm filibustering. My answers are so long. We can go for another 5 minutes or so.
Okay, perfect. Well, then I had a question just to circle back to what you talked about with the role of luck in the draft. I think that's really amazing that you guys are, you know, cognizant of it or thinking about it in the process of trying to, you know, decide what the lottery should look like, what the distribution of talent should look like, because of the way that you almost have to get lucky twice. You have to get lucky in like how you know your record, sort of setting up your record, what you think it's going to be if you're trying to target a certain draft position, but then also you have to get the lottery ball to bounce your way to get to a certain position, and then you also have to have that player work out. You know, you can have a really good plan, but then luck can intervene in so many different ways.
Right, and my experience is that virtually every general manager in this league is overconfident about his or her ability to predict the future.
Yeah, there was a paper on that in the NFL. I don't know if you saw it, but it was long ago, but where economists actually looked at sort of like, do these experts in the NFL, these decision makers, do they make the right pick, and do they trade in a way, I guess they looked at draft pick trades, that would imply that they have this like great confidence in their ability, and they showed that like the curve of confidence in their ability to make the right pick was very different than the actual outcomes of the players that got picked at each slot.
Absolutely. I didn't see that paper, but I've seen summaries of it, and people talk about that theory a lot in the league.
It's interesting because athletes are also sort of have to be overconfident in order to get, you know, to be as good as they can be. There's maybe a shared psychology in there between the two. Commissioner, we're interested always here in data availability, since 538 sort of founded on that idea, and we've especially written and run into problems of data availability in women's sports in the last couple of years that we've been in our ESPN iteration. And we were thinking about that in regards to WNBA, where about half of the arenas are equipped with sports view cameras because the arena is shared with an NBA team, but that there's no sports view data coming out of them for the WNBA teams. And I was wondering if there are any plans to make the analytics more robust than the WNBA, as we've seen it really benefit the NBA.
Yeah, there are, and one of the problems is without a complete data set, you know, it's not clear it makes sense to then, you know, go to the expense of of collecting the data, but it's on the list of issues for the WNBA has, in essence, its own board of governors. That's what we call the management group of owners who run the league. And in fact, I'm glad you asked about the WNBA because we're going into the 20th season of the WNBA. And I was here at the NBA at the beginning of the WNBA with, of course, David Stern and Val Ackerman, who was the first president of WNBA. And I think the 20th anniversary is an incredible milestone, so much so that things like adding better analytics, increasing our exposures on ESPN, we have a new Nike deal for the WNBA where they're going to heard directly from Mark Parker, the CEO, said he's personally going to oversee a sort of fresh look at what the uniforms should be for WNBA players as opposed to just, you know, taking the traditional men's basketball uniform and cutting it slightly different for women. And so, I think the caliber of women's basketball has increased exponentially since we launched this league. And so we are doubling and tripling down on the league, and we want to make sure that in all categories, you know, whether it be the marketing, the exposures, or the analytics for that matter, that it's first rate. So that's something we will be looking at as well.
So you said you're trying to, the owners and you will have a conversation about whether it makes sense financially to make that more robust. How do you make that kind of decision? Because analytics are almost always sort of like a bonus or an add-on. They help the teams, of course, plan their own strategies better as well. But as far as the fan-facing part of it, that's really something it's hard to quantify, I would think, just what that's worth to a league.
It's hard to quantify, although there are indicias of the interest of our fans. For example, we've taken a lot of the new generation analytics, and through this relationship we have with SAP, we've made it available on NBA.com. So we can track directly what fields of data our fans are interested in and what, you know, the different ways that our fans are interested in massaging the data. And for us, we can measure it in engagement. I mean, to the extent that more fans want to spend more time on WNBA.com or on the WNBA app using that data and becoming more engaged in the sport, it's not a direct science, but at least we can see trend lines that support making increased investments in the sport.
Okay, one last one for you. You've been very vocal in public about your thinking that we need to rethink the way that we approach sports gambling in the country. And I was wondering, based on what you've seen happen with daily fantasy sites over the last year or so, or a few months or so, with FanDuel and DraftKings, has the reception to those two services and the way that regulatory authorities have come down on them made you rethink your own stance on sports gambling and sports betting?
Not at all. If anything, I mean, before we get to the regulatory aspect, the fact that those sites, largely DraftKings and FanDuel, grew so fast, you know, in such a large volume, and to me that demonstrates, and I won't go there in terms of, you know, skill versus luck or whatever or chance, whatever the standard is, only in that this is an activity that there's unquestionable, enormous demand for, and I think based on what we're seeing in the enormous interest in these sites, I'd say largely unmet demand in our society. And one of the reasons that I've been pushing to legalize sports betting is not because I'm necessarily an advocate of sports betting. It's because all of the research shows that it's a multi-hundred billion dollar business just in the United States right now. And that in terms of the integrity of the sports leagues, it's only bad news for us when it continues to remain underground, and that to the extent whether there are fantasy sites or then flat-out betting sites where consumers identify themselves by putting credit cards in, and that they then can be tracked in the same way the stock market can track. The stock market tracks buying and selling, that's much healthier for the leagues. And if there's aberrant behavior, again, just like with any exchange like the New York Stock Exchange, when there's aberrant behavior, you know, flags are raised, bells go off, and then they investigate. And so my view is that daily fantasy should be a regulated industry in New York and elsewhere. And I think ultimately that should be a decision for the voters. So whether or not the Attorney General is right that under a statute in New York, daily fantasy is something that should be considered gambling and therefore not allowed, I think that's just a short-term issue. The longer-term issue is for the legislature to decide whether daily fantasy is an activity that they, our representatives think is appropriate for the people of New York State to engage in. And I just go one step further. I think now, maybe selfishly on behalf of a sports league, but I think a uniform code across all 50 states makes more sense than a hodgepodge of regulations, especially when you're dealing with the internet. And as they have now, for example, in the state of New Jersey, online poker is permissible. You have to be geographically located in New Jersey. And I've read lots of stories about professional poker players who therefore move to, Weehawken, and get an apartment, and they sit in their apartment because that's where it's permissible to play, online poker for money. It just seems that this day and age, as disruptive as the internet has been, that this is something, not to say this is should be at the top of Congress's list with all that's going on in the world, but at some point Congress should address this and come up with a uniform code that deals with sports betting, deals with daily fantasy. So and by the way, and maybe with that uniform code, it makes sense to me then if a particular state wants to opt out, and I understand that if a state were to say we don't want daily fantasy in our jurisdiction or we don't want sports betting, that's fine too.
Well, especially maybe Congress should do that just to keep us all from having to move to Weehawken, I guess. But I know
it's
we said
a bad place, by the way, Weehawken. It's right across the Hudson from the NBA.
Yeah. So I know we said that was the last question, but quick question. Who wins a championship first, the Sixers or the Cubs?
I can't answer that.
Fair enough.
I can only say I hope the 76ers win first, because I only focus on the NBA.
You don't have your baseball versus NBA statistical models right in front of you? You can just type in a few queries and off it goes?
No.
Okay.
By the way, I'm a New York, I'm a Yankee fan, so another reason why I hope the 76ers win before the Cubs.
All right, Commissioner Adam Silver, thanks so much for coming on Hot Takedown.
Thanks, guys.
So, Neil, what was the thing that stuck out most from our conversation?
So, I mean, I thought it was, he said that he wasn't a fan. He specifically said he wasn't a fan of what the Sixers are doing. And then he also kind of painted it in this way of, it's a collaborative process. He himself as the commissioner, doesn't have the power to do that. And I think that's, we can kind of debate about how much that's true, because we've seen his predecessor, David Stern, step in various trades. Chris Paul comes to mind and various other things. So I don't know. What do you think? What
stuck
out to you?
To me, the theme out of all that was the limits of power, basically. Mm-hmm. And what whether you and I personally agree with the ones that he laid out. And the ones that he laid out, I think he said at one point the word cajole, right? Mm-hmm. That he's basically a soft power guy. He's a diplomat. He's behind the scenes. These owners elected him to be the commissioner, and so he's at the service of them while also being at the service of the corporation and the fans, and they're all, of course, interwoven because money's involved in all three. Is it, he said in the beginning that he admitted that there was a draft process that's now on hold, a draft reformation process that's now on hold because three quarters of the teams didn't want it. And then the question is, well, if the league wants it, can you drag some teams over into wanting it? And sort of trying to figure out what he's comfortable with telling us, but also comfortable with in general, about the limitations of his power and what his role is in the NBA, I think is very interesting.
Right. And then the other thing that was interesting was he talked about going to the length of having an internal committee or group that their job is to try to figure out ways to crack whatever sort of plan that they put in place and how teams are going to try to exploit that. And the idea that there's almost like a bunch of knobs that you can turn, on Adam Silver's control panel to, you turn one knob, it changes things in an unexpected way, and then you have to turn another one to compensate for that. And so it gave me the sense of having to find like this very delicate balance between everything that tries to make perhaps no one truly happy, but no one truly miserable.
And I don't want to overdo it on the diplomacy metaphor, but like there is a real politic worldview, I think, inherent in that, which is the assumption that no legislation, if you will, no decree or reformation can ever be perfect, because the market finds loopholes. The market finds a way. And in my diplomacy example, there's the countries find a way to work around whatever agreed upon in a treaty, let's say, something like that. And that I think it says something that our modern day sports leagues are developed enough in at least analytic thinking, if not analytics themselves, to think about how a bunch of different actors will try and exploit and find market advantage.
Right. And his answer, if we take it at face value about, you know, his feelings personally about the Sixers and his power to stop it, is that, you know, the market will have to work it out. And if Sam Hinkie is, you know, and his experiment, his process is not effective, then, you know, eventually the Sixers will replace him. And in a certain kind of quasi way, we don't know how much, that is already starting to happen.
But even the market has the Fed, right? And like, that's the thing, is like, this idea of the market as a totally free market, in which there are no regulatory bodies, and there's no person in charge, I think is not quite the right analogy to what we're seeing in the NBA. But, you know, That Adam Silver has lots going on that I'm not aware of, I'm sure, behind the scenes, and you got the sense that there were certainly conversations happening outside of our view. So, Neil, in preparation for this podcast and for talking to Commissioner Silver, we knew we were going to ask him about Sam Hinkie and the Sixers, especially at the news that Jerry Colangelo, who's the director of USA Basketball, would come in and take charge of some operations within the Sixers. I think the power sharing agreement's not entirely clear, to talk more about power, but I know you ran some numbers, and I'm wondering, I mean, just how bad has Hinkie's reign been for the Sixers?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, the Sixers are always kind of a punchline that we have, but we sort of put them in this bin as being really bad, but don't sort of talk about, like, how bad would we expect them to be, perhaps even in the context of tanking.
So expect how so? Like, given where they started before Hinkie came in?
Or even, like, given the fact that here is a rebuilding team, just sort of, you know, there have been perhaps no one as barefaced, you know, in this attempt to try to get bad to get good as the Sixers have been under Hinkie, but certainly rebuilding a franchise is a term that's been around for many decades, and many teams have gone through that cycle, and some have made it out and some have stalled out and gone through, you know, another cycle of it before they got good again. So what I did was I did a couple things. I used our ELO rating, which is just this measurement of team power, team strength in any given moment, and I looked at teams where a new GM is taking over and they sort of go through like a transition year where they get worse the first year, and then, you know, they're trying to make progress going forward.
So this was Hinkie like 3 years
ago. Plan. Yeah. He took over as GM. His first full season was 2013/14. The Sixers were coming out of this Doug Collins regime that had been around for a few years, and they were starting over, pressing the reset button. And so, you know, maybe you give them like 1 year of leeway before they start to try to, you know, make progress. And I looked at the difference in ELO between the start of the second season and 27 games into the third season, which is where the Sixers are right now.
And so again, all we're trying to figure out here is team quality. This isn't about player development. I mean, that's all baked into this team quality.
Exactly, yeah. And you can't single out like, oh, is the coach letting the team down by not improving the players? Were they, you know, drafting poorly? And like Adam Silver mentioned, a lot of that is luck. That's all baked in. We're just saying eventually the purview of the GM is to kind of oversee all of this stuff. And how much of it is his total responsibility is sort of, you know, a matter of debate, but just in broad strokes, we can kind of pick up on things. So we looked at it and we found that Hinkie himself has overseen the biggest decline of any GM in this data set that matches, and this is out of 33 GMs since really of all time. We looked at going back to the history of the NBA.
So these 33 GMs had a team that was as bad as the Sixers?
Yeah, or? Well, so it took over a team that was below average before they started, then they got worse than that in the first year, and then judging on their progress from that point forward.
Okay.
And so Hinkie was the worst, overseeing a pretty substantial drop since even the start of his second year in charge. And then I thought it was especially funny that the guy who showed up as the best in terms of overseeing the most successful rebuild, and this was a rebuild from scratch, so maybe it was a build, not a rebuild, because they were an expansion franchise, but it was the Phoenix Suns under Jerry Colangelo,
oh,
who is Hinkie's now sort of foil. I don't know what he is. So that was interesting. And that's not the only way to look at it. For instance, we also thought like, oh, well, what if we treated the Sixers of 2014 sort of like they're an expansion team, right? Like they totally pressed the reset button. They were as bad as an expansion team if you look at the players that are on the roster. So we say, okay, let's actually, according to ELO, just give you the starting rating of a franchise that has never existed before and then just sort of run with it. See where you took it from there and compare you to all of the other expansion teams that came in since the NBA merged with the ABA in 1976. So that was a total of, I want to say, eight expansion teams other than the quote-unquote Sixers who were treating as an expansion team. And those teams all uniformly got better, some substantially so, by the 27-game mark of their third season of existence.
Which is where the Sixers are now.
Right, which is where the Sixers are right now.
So you're telling me the Sixers are worse than they were, than they should be if they were just an expansion
team? Even if
we
treated the Sixers as an expansion team when Hinkie came in, the Sixers are almost 5 points per game worse than the average expansion team since the ABA
merger. So they're like prenatal, basically. Like,
yeah,
like
they
Sam
have
Hinkie
like regressed.
Taken, yeah.
And in fact, none of the other actual expansion teams got worse between their inception and 27 games of their third season. The Sixers have gotten worse, and they've gotten significantly worse since then. So it's like it is like regressing back into the womb if we're taking this metaphor too far with the Sixers, if we're treating them as like the birth of the franchise took place. So I think by any standard statistically, if we're taking like a very big picture look at their progress report through, you know, maybe a quarter or a third of the third season of this project that Hinkie has set forth, they are way behind schedule. Now, that comes with a caveat, and Adam Silver even touched on this a little bit, is that, you know, they're trying perhaps for something different than the average expansion team. I think when you come into existence as a brand new franchise, you're trying to make incremental progress and you're trying to just show improvement and trying to get better and establish yourself as a team in the league. The Sixers' stated goal under Hinkie has been to build a championship team, or not, and not even that, a dynasty. And so they've used that as sort of this justification for, you know, we're not trying to hit singles here, we're trying to hit home runs. And if you try to hit home runs, sometimes you'll strike out and you got to be prepared for this boom and bust. And in this case, you know, some of their picks early on, whether it be by choice with Embiid, you know, being an injured player, Noel, you know, when he first started out, they knew that he would miss some time, that, you know, they have gone through these learning curves and these, you know, fits and starts because they have taken risks, and sometimes the risks haven't worked out and you have to be prepared to suffer the consequences of that. But ultimately, you know, I am not sure that I totally agree with that justification, or I think that that explains fully what's going on. I think at a certain point, I mean, this is the fourth biggest market in the U.S., and it has a team that is a laughingstock, and there's no evidence, you know, according to some of the studies that I've seen done, that tanking is really a more effective way, you know, that you have to be really bad to get really good, that you can actually just as easily get really good from being, you know, sort of in the middle of the league. And that runs counter to the thought process that was in place a few years ago when, say, the Miami Heat were dominating because they got LeBron, and you thought, oh, you know, the only way to win is to get one of these guys, a LeBron-type player in the draft, or have them come to your team via free agency, and it seemed like there was a crisis going on in the league. But now, you know, we've seen the Warriors organically become
great. We talk about these swings of conventional wisdom a lot,
right,
on the show, where it's sort of it's hard to figure out, because the NBA evolves so quickly, it's hard to figure out whether or not what we're seeing is a true maximization, optimization of the way of what it is, of how to win in the NBA, or if we're just seeing fads wash in and wash out, like you know, as if it's the tide or something.
Right, and there's no way. I mean, in the short term scale, we only have one champion per year, so in some ways, it's like tough to discern how much.
Right,
of that
what we
is
need
chance.
Is like a full 50-60 year study of NBA champions and like what they. What their strategy was relative to the rest of the league.
Yeah.
That's really, you know, if you drop the Warriors in 1962 basketball right now, I don't know, there's no three-point line, so maybe it doesn't work. But, you know, there's so many other variables and factors flowing in and out.
Right. And so that makes it tough to figure out, you know, and tease out how much of it is a legitimate strategy. But certainly the only sort of known test that we have so far where a team went into it and said, we are multi-year tanking and, you know, trying to bottom out for the draft pick, picks. And we've seen this happen with other franchises, but it was sort of a partial mix of bad luck. You know, Duncan came to the Spurs because David Robinson was injured for 1 year, but that wasn't planned. And, you know, the Oklahoma City Thunder are sort of a one-time case in which everything worked out right in that situation, but I don't think that they were in part of a multi-year, you know, plan for bottoming out. That, you know, this is the only experiment that we have, and right now it has not worked out on the same schedule as other similarly bad teams from history.
Maybe the Sixers are going to prevent all sorts of teams from winning championships in the future who would have tanked,
but they got scared off.
One small sample size example.
That's right.
Okay, Neil, I think we have an appointment at the screen printing shop that we have to go make these t-shirts.
Gotta make some t-shirts.
I want what color do you want? I'm thinking like canary.
What are our options?
Yeah, we got to go to this shop and find out. This shop also might just be called like Cafe Press or something.
I actually want the colors of the original Vancouver Grizzlies. I feel like that would kind of go in
retro,
you know,
chic.
Yeah, but can I also get you know, some kind of like Grizzlies font or something on it? Mm-hmm. I feel like that was the most 90s of all NBA jersey.
I mean, we could just put
Big Country
a little
Reeves on the back, like a jersey of him. I don't know.
We could just put silver on top of that Grizzlies logo.
Yeah,
right. Just like writing. I think it was it on all fours or was it standing up? I forget that old Grizzlies logo.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's fair use now, probably. I don't know. Like,
NBA trademarks expire.
Yeah, exactly.
Commissioner Silver seemed like he was buddy-buddy with us.
Cool.
I'm sure he wouldn't bring a lawsuit against us for infringing. All right, Neil, thanks as always.
Hey, thanks, Chad.
It's only the two of us. I have no one else to thank this show.
I know.
Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast commissioner is Jody Avergan. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We get production assistance from Tony Chow and Lois St. Jacques. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at iTunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. One more reminder, we are going to be at Stat School next week between Christmas and New Year's, and then we will be back come 2016. Big year for Hot Takedown. Big year.
Huge.
You have Hot Takedown resolutions?
Huge year.
Just to talk more like Mike Francesa?
Yeah, I'm going to take down more hot takes, I think.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
That's original.
Isn't that always the resolution we should have?
All right. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.